Here, the broad five different ways along a kind of spectrum from least oppositional to most oppositional, or put another way, from those that are properly understood as just sort of alternatives and those that are oppositional. And I'm always reminded, I was thinking about you know the whole language of oppositional architecture, and I was reminded of the Raymond Williams line. And I'm sorry, I'm going to read this. I won't read most of the rest of my talk or any of the rest of my talk. But the comment from Raymond Williams that there's a simple theoretical distinction between alternative and oppositional. That is to say, between someone who simply finds a different way to live and wishes to be left alone with it, and someone who finds a different way to live and wants to change society in that light. And this is usually the difference between individual and small group solutions to social crisis and those solutions which properly belong to political and ultimately revolutionary practice. But it is often a very narrow line in reality between alternative and oppositional. And a meaning or a practice may be tolerated as a deviation, that is, an alternative may be tolerated as a deviation, and yet still be seen only as another particular way to live. But as a necessary area of effective dominance ends, the meanings and practices can be seen by the dominant culture not merely as disregarding it or despising it, but as challenging it. And so actually, when alternatives grow enough and become routine enough, at some point, there is inevitably going to be pushback. And so even things that are you know not reflexively or consciously oppositional or radical, but are fundamentally different and qualitatively different than the way things are normally done, at some point there is going to be a pushback if they become established enough. And then the questions become, the real political questions become, what are the reactions to the pushback? And what is the base of support that those alternatives have to enable them to deal with the pushback from capital. So in any case, the five broad types. First of all, there's been an incredible growth in what are called deed-restricted home ownership. And this is, mostly fairly apolitical stuff coming out of a lot of inclusionary zoning developments that have mandatory caps on resale prices for homes. It's very mainstream. Inclusionary zoning is hardly radical in the context of contemporary planning, but it is producing a sizable number of units that are to some degree limited in the extent to which they operate in the market. We don't have great numbers on how many units have been produced that are deed restricted. The numbers range from about 100,000 nationwide to about 300,000 nationwide, and a big chunk of those are in the states of California and New Jersey, which have long had inclusionary zoning requirements written into state court, or coming out of state court decisions. The second one is the community land trust model. The community land trust model is a fascinating model. It emerged originally in 1968 in rural Georgia as a way to prevent black property owners from having their properties taken from them by predatory lenders who are essentially stripping the equity from their farms and then coming in and taking the farms through foreclosure. And it was a way to essentially decommodify the property. That's brought into cities in the 1980s in the context of the gentrification that we saw in the wave of gentrification that began in the late 70s and continued until the very late 80s. And has grown since then. And very briefly, the way a land trust works is you separate the improvements on the land, that is the housing units on the land, from the land itself. The people that own their homes on the land own their homes, but they do not own the land. The land is in trust, and the trust is controlled usually in a tripartite board structure. One third is unit owners on the land. One third is community members, other community members that aren't unit owners, and one third is people from other not-for-profit organizations in the larger city that the land trust happens to be in. A lot of interest and a lot of growth around CLTs in the last decade, and in particular in the last couple of years. And we're now at about 160 operating community land trusts in the United States, but they only have about 10,000 units on them. So it's still fairly small scale, but it has been growing, and it's been growing in a diverse set of cities. So you have, you know, St. Joe's Carpenter Society in Camden. And I don't know if people know Camden in New Jersey, but it's one of the poorest cities in the country. But you also have growth in land trusts in places like Portland, Portland, Oregon, as a reaction to how to deal with property prices going up because of the very strong anti-sprawl laws that they have in Portland. And so it's growing in a lot of different contexts at this point. Third form that I want to talk about is limited equity co-ops. Limited equity co-ops are created originally in the 1920s in New York City. And the way a limited equity co-op works is that it's a co-op in the sense of that the unit owners, they aren't unit owners, they have a share in the cooperative corporation that owns the property, like every other kind of co-op. But how they can sell it and to whom they can sell it to and for how much they can sell it is greatly constrained. And in many co-ops, in many limited equity co-ops, the resale prices are pretty close to zero equity co-ops. There are, at this point, about 400,000 units in limited equity co-ops in the United States. It's by a comfortable majority, the largest form of decommodified or partially decommodified or mostly decommodified in some cases type of housing that we have in the United States. About half of those are in the five boroughs of New York. And so we have like 60,000 in Mitchell-Lama limited equity co-ops. We have a whole bunch that were built in the 1920s, many of which remain as limited equity co-ops. We have about 50,000 that were created out of the 1970s crisis and all of the abandonment that we saw during the fiscal crisis of the 1970s when New York City was bankrupt. The fourth way is mutual housing associations. Mutual housing associations were created much more recently, created in the late 1970s, actually created by government action. It was an act of Congress created the Neighborhood Reinvestment Corporation that went to Germany to study the German housing associations that had been built in the post-war period and to do that form or something borrowing from that form of housing development in the United States. There was a lot of attention and a lot of growth in mutual housing. The way mutual housing associations work is that the property and the units are completely outside of the market. And that the residents they don't own the association, but they control the association by virtue of controlling the board that governs the association. And what they pay is based on a percent of their rent, a percent of their income. And it's not rent, they call it housing charges usually. There are only about 40 of those, and interest in that in mutual housing peaked probably in the early 90s and hasn't really gone anywhere since. But there are about 40 of them operating in the United States, and only about 5,000 or 6,000 units. And then the last one is, of course, squatting. And squatting is interesting because we don't have as much of a history or as large scale a history of squatting in American cities as there are in other cities around the world, but we have had moments where squatting has certainly emerged as a pursued and viable option. And we're seeing that again now. There was a big boom in the 1970s, again in the context of urban abandonment that we were seeing in American cities, and we're seeing it again now. Groups like Back to the Land, and I know you guys, you're having them come up from Miami and that's great, but also Picture the Homeless here in New York has been doing a bunch of very visible squatting in Spanish Harlem, and it's gotten some fairly interesting public support. The way things are right now, the first three of these, deed-restricted home ownership, land trust, and limited equity co-ops, are witnessing kind of an explosion of interest and support from them, for them, from places that you wouldn't actually necessarily think. So, for instance, the Ford Foundation had for a very long time only, had a policy of only funding fee simple home ownership, that is, straightforward home ownership, and they weren't going to fund anything other than that. At this point, George McCarthy, who's a program officer for housing at Ford, is running around the country saying that the 20% of the American housing stock, about 25 million units of housing in the United States, should be partially decommodified, should be put into land trusts. Or now, I don't know if Mac is serious, and I don't know if Ford is serious, and foundations get fads into their head for a funding cycle that lasts 3 or 4 years, and then they lose interest, or you know, Mac will go to UNC or wherever, and it'll die. But right now, there's an incredible amount of interest in that. The new head of Rockefeller, whose name is escaping me at this moment, used to be the president of the University of Pennsylvania, said the biggest mistake she ever made when she was president of the University of Pennsylvania was not putting, when they did all that development in West Philly, was not putting it all into land trust. So as a way to avoid gentrification. Now, I don't know that I believe her, and I know that the developments in West Philly were touching in the extreme, but this is a conversation that we would not have heard from foundations, and I don't think for a second that foundations are going to lead radical or transformative social change, but the fact that this is a conversation that people at Ford and Rockefeller are not just entertaining but actively pursuing is definitely worth noticing, and worth commenting on. You're getting a whole set of interest from local governments. So you can, the city of Newark is now working with a set of community groups and trying to bring in UHAB from New York, at least technical capacity from UHAB, to put big chunks, because a city like Newark, I mean, Newark has been devastated. I don't know if people walked around Newark, walked around the Ironbound, the South Ironbound, or the East Ironbound, or the Central Ward, a whole set of neighborhoods in Newark that have been absolutely demolished by the foreclosure crisis, where you're looking at blocks where 80-90% of the homes on the blocks are in foreclosure and abandoned and bank-owned at this point. And the question then becomes, what do we do with all this stuff? And so the city government, and Newark's city government is a world into itself in lots of ways, most of them not very fun, but it is working with community groups to build the capacity to turn them into limited equity co-ops. And even the Neighborhood Stabilization Program has a decent chunk of money to put things into land trust and to partially decommodify the properties. Now the questions then become, what are the political meanings of this? We have all of this interest, from people that are not especially interested in radical transformation. Part of what's going on right now is a whole set of fights from people in this effort to define what it is our it is and what it is our goals are. So, for instance, there's a group of a coalition of community groups in Nashville, Tennessee, that are in the middle of putting together a fairly sizable combination land trust limited equity co-op scheme for affordable housing in Nashville. A National Co-op Bank, which is funneling money into the process because it's National Co-op Bank and they want to get back into housing funding. Had a huge fight with them because they wanted to take some of the money from National Co-op Bank and hire a full-time community organizer to build community capacity, to build community input and community investment and community control in the process and what was going on. And National Co-op Bank said they were going to pull the whole thing if they went ahead and hired a full-time community organizer. And so we're looking at fights right now in the political definition of what it is we're trying to do. We can see things like the state government of California, which is very supportive of community land trusts and is putting money into land, and which is sort of a remarkable thing because it's the state of California at this point. But has made it very clear in its funding guidelines, quote, "We do not want to create a separate class of homeowners who have no stake in the home itself. That is essentially renters, as though renters have no stake in their own home. And so we require equity sharing to help build wealth." And so, as this is going on, there is very much a live conversation about what it is we're trying to do. And I would say, and the last thing I would say about the politics and how this is all shaking out is that the political meanings of all this stuff is not set in stone. I mean, you have a whole set of different actors that are in the process of trying to define what this means. There, the residents, there's the larger community beyond the residents. There's the organizational staff, if there's a not-for-profit involved, and it very often is. There's the foundation, and then there's the state, whether it be the local state or the state government, or in some cases, the national government. And they're all they're all in the process of trying to define what it is or it is. And it's actually a bit of a moving target. I remember I was doing work with the Mutual Housing Association in Stamford, Connecticut a few years ago. And one of the striking things was when I talked to the residents, I did a survey of the residents in Mutual Housing in Stamford, and when I asked them why they moved in, the reasons why they all moved in were things like, well, it was clean, and it was, you know, it was a good, it's close to where I needed to be, close to you know, family, work, school, whatever. You know, it was safe. And when I asked them what they liked about it, they said the fact that I control my property, that I'm involved in the community. And there is a transformation in what it is people are understanding. And so the fact that the political content is being fought over also has to be sort of filtered through the fact that the political content itself is, you know, is not fixed. And especially for many residents, you know, and you look at the residents that were put together, the Limited Equity Co-ops in the 1970s are saying, after they did that, the realization that they could do that, that they could take ownership of the property that, you know, that their landlord had and it had, you know, beaten into the ground, then opens up this whole other set of, you know, the realization of potential is itself an incredibly politically important thing. And so again, the political content of this is being written. And the last thing I would say, and I've probably done my 15 minutes already, the last thing I would say is that limited equity co-ops were created in the first instance in New York City by the Amalgamated Union, by Amalgamated Clothing, and they weren't Act Two at that point, but the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union in 1927 and Amalgamated Houses in the Bronx. It's the first limited equity co-op in the United States in 1927 was created, and unions aren't part of this conversation in 2009. And at some point, that, you know, there has to be some kind of way to not have that continue to be the case. And if there is a large player that could be potentially useful in the definition of the politics of what it is that is already happening, then unions, I think, need to be brought into that. And thank you. Sorry. And did you just go to Esther? Yeah. Yeah.